I next met with Dr. David Spriggs, and continuing down the personal case-based patient path, we chatted about cases from his practice.
The first patient is a patient from my practice who is 62 years old, Gravita 3, Para 3, and she really had no significant medical history when she sought medical attention for abdominal pain and a sense of bloating. I thought that that was a fairly typical presentation and would be the kind of things that people in practice would probably be seeing. The examination is notable for bilateral adnexal fullness and probable ascites, although not massive ascites. And her initial CA-125 was characteristically up in the 1,000 range. It was 984. She had a preoperative CT scan, which confirmed her masses, as well as retroperitoneal adenopathy and ascites. And so she was seen by a gynecologic oncologist. She underwent a total abdominal hysterectomy, bilateral salpingooephrectomy, a node dissection, omentectomy, and upper abdominal exploration with the removal of a nodular mass from the liver capsule. At the end of the operation, she was left with miliary disease on the small bowel surface, but she was optimally debulked.
And when was it that she had the surgery?
She had the surgery at this point, it was about 11 months ago.
And when did you first see her?
Well, that's an interesting point. And as you probably know, in the JCO recently, there was a nice paper suggesting that the interval of time between the diagnosis or onset of symptoms and the surgery does not really have a profound impact on the outcome, that by the time patients have symptoms, they're mostly stage 3 disease. And so in this case, she had her surgery. We saw her a couple of weeks afterward, which is about the time that we generally see these patients. And we would not offer intraperitoneal treatment until she was 3 or 4 weeks out just because of the incision.
Now, just out of curiosity, when you saw her, was that after ASCO 2010?
Yes, it would have been July or August.
So it was kind of right after the big ASCO meeting. And what were the protocol and non-protocol options that you considered for her?
Well, the protocol option is all of our upfront patients are offered GOG trials. We had a upfront treatment where we were still looking at the 252, which is a randomized study looking at cisplatin, IP carboplatin, and IP carbopaclitaxel. And all three arms have bevacizumab in them. And so the 252 study, all of those patients would then have the opportunity to get bevacizumab.
Let me add that the chemo in the three different arms of the GOG 252 study consists of IV paclitaxel carboplatin on arm 1, IV paclitaxel and intraperitoneal carbo on arm 2, and IV and IP paclitaxel and IP cisplatinum on arm 3. And as you mentioned, all three arms get concurrent Bev every 3 weeks times 6. Now, what about non-protocol options for this patient?
Non-protocol options, our practice last year up until this year at ASCO really reflected an opportunity to just do carbo and paclitaxel IV or the intraperitoneal cisplatin program that we'd been developing.
So what ended up happening? What did she and you choose to do?
Well, she decided not to go on protocol therapy. She was, I think, as some patients are, a little suspicious of the protocol therapy early in her course. What we often find is that patients, even at Memorial Hospital, need to have a relationship with a physician before they're willing to go on to investigational programs, even what we would consider to be fairly straightforward ones. So we offered her primary therapy with cisplatin, IP, paclitaxel IV, but we were not using bevacizumab in that context.
And what happened?
She did very well. Her CA-125 normalized after 2 cycles, and she got to the end of her therapy and was rescanned. At the time of rescanning, she had no evidence of disease. She was left with a grade 1 peripheral neuropathy and some mild magnesium wasting from the cisplatin, but in general, she has done well since that time. We routinely are following these patients on an every 3-month basis. Because she started out without any evidence of disease, but had a elevated CA-125 when she was originally diagnosed, we feel pretty comfortable following these people with CA-125 and exams and only using the CT scans to confirm changes in those two ideas.
So you mentioned the fact that if she had gone on the study, it would have been with bevacizumab. Can you kind of provide an update, particularly related to the last ASCO meeting or where we are with bevacizumab and ovarian cancer?
Well, I think that the data in ovarian cancer has continued to accumulate in a very positive way. There were two important abstracts related to bevacizumab that were presented at the oral sessions of ASCO this year. The first was a first relapse study, the so-called OCEAN studies, that was presented by Carol Agajanian. And in that study, they were able to show that there was a very big time to progression advantage in the patients who had received bevacizumab plus carboplatin and gemcitabine, as opposed to the carboplatin gemcitabine plus placebo group. And that study was chosen specifically as a registration strategy because, of course, the carboplatin gemcitabine was the backbone that had gotten gemcitabine approved in ovarian cancer a couple of years ago when it was done by the AGO investigators. So the very positive nature of that study really reinforces that bevacizumab plus the carboplatin-based treatment seems to be a positive option and extend at least time to progression. The second abstract that was presented was the survival data from an unplanned subgroup analysis out of the ICON 7 study. Now, the ICON 7 study was a carboplatin paclitaxel plus or minus bevacizumab in the European consortia. And in that group, they also showed that there was a significant time to progression advantage. But last year, when that was presented, there was really no survival data available. And what the investigators did was they went back and they looked at some unplanned subgroups and looked at the patients with the worst prognosis, that is the patients with suboptimal disease or with stage 4 disease. And of course, those are the patients that would be expected to relapse first. And so if you're looking for a survival advantage, you'd have to go to a group that has a lot of events. And so that group turns out to be the suboptimal group. And what they were able to show was that there was an emerging survival advantage in that subgroup. Now, we don't know for sure how that's going to play out over time with the whole study. And since many of those patients would have been the same patients that were present in GOG-218, the prior study, where there were a large number of suboptimal patients, we don't yet have any survival data from that study as well. So I think that those two studies taken together, I think what we can say is that there's encouraging information to suggest that just as with other agents in ovarian cancer, time to progression turns out to be a pretty good surrogate for overall survival in frontline and probably second-line therapy. So I think that the ICON 7 data is probably really important in terms of getting the indication for ovarian cancer within the United States and having bevacizumab approved specifically for ovarian cancer.
So how would you evaluate her risk of cancer progression?
She belongs in a better risk group because she had visible disease but was optimally debulked. And when one thinks about end of the operation, there are three really important subgroups. One is the suboptimal group where the disease is greater than 1 centimeter. The second is visible disease but less than 1 centimeter. And then the third group are the patients that have no visible disease at all. And surgical studies suggest very strongly that those three groups do have different prognosis. And the better the debulking, the more likely it is those patients are going to have long-term survival.
So she was in the middle group?
She would be in the middle group.
You know, I've got to say, I guess there are a couple of ways to look at the data that you've just been talking about. One would be that bevacizumab, you know, maybe has more effect or anti-angiogenesis with more disease present as opposed to, you know, microscopic. We already know from colon cancer, it doesn't seem to help there in adjuvant therapy. But another way to look at it, it kind of reminds me of the breast cancer adjuvant trials, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, where initially they didn't see a survival benefit in node-negative patients, but they did in node-positive, and eventually it kind of turned into an events thing. Do you think that's what's going on here, or do you think biologically Bev works better when there's more disease?
I think that it probably is more of the events phenomena than it is an established disease, because remember that most of these patients will have a very good response to platinum, And so whether they start out with suboptimal disease or not, by the time they finish six cycles of platinum-based therapy, most of them are going to have very, very small volume disease or no disease at all. And so I think that what you're looking at then is you're just looking at a rate of relapse, and it happens sooner for suboptimal patients.
That's the one I'm buying into. Anything new in terms of side effects, toxicity of bevacizumab that's been reported recently?
You know, I think that by the time the bevacizumab data got into ovarian cancer, most of the side effects were pretty well understood. I think that the big disadvantage of Bev in ovary cancer is, like with gastric cancer, there is a perforation rate. And there was a big scare about whether or not that was going to really preclude the use of bevacizumab in the bulk of ovarian cancer patients. And that's turned out not to be terrible. I think that the incidence rates are below 1%. And so the perforation has really, I think, it's still there and it needs to be discussed, but it's really not the 5 to 10% that people were afraid of when it was originally introduced.
So what other trial concepts are being discussed or being implemented in this situation now?
Well, I think that the question about where bevacizumab is going to fit into the overall armamentarium, I think at this point is quite controversial. And it is reminiscent of how the different sides of the Atlantic handled paclitaxel a decade ago, which is there seems to be for these truly effective drugs like paclitaxel or bevacizumab a benefit, and you can get the benefit in the early going or you can get the benefit later on, and in each case there seems to be substantial benefit, and we really don't have a good idea about whether or not the frontline therapy is going to be necessary for all these patients, or what it's really doing is it's delaying recurrence and therefore extending survival, but we're not curing more patients. And I think that's an important differential, because if Bev is truly curing more patients, then you have to really look favorably on using it in frontline therapy. If it's delaying the time to recurrence, the time to recurrence in a chronic disease like ovarian cancer is probably less important, and you could easily spare the upfront patient the bevacizumab exposure and leave that opportunity open for drugs that might actually increase cure rate. And so at this point, I tend to think it's more the second, that it's not providing additional curative treatment, but it's really providing extended life to most of the patients who are receiving it.
So in terms of research strategies in the earlier setting, in a lot of the tumors, solid tumors, and you know, really in hematologic cancer has already been true, we're seeing trials adding in biologics on top of standard, usually chemotherapy. Is that the thinking in ovarian cancer? And what are the agents that are closest to being studied in earlier stage disease?
Well, I think in ovary cancer, the next big GOG study is not going to be using bevacizumab in the upfront setting, but it's going to leave it as an option. And the drugs that are going to be most important are, we're moving on to the PARP inhibitors, the so-called ADP polyribose polymerase inhibitors. And those PARPs have been much anticipated, and the development has been in some ways disappointingly slow as we get into actually treating those patients. But I think that the upfront studies with the PARP inhibitors are probably the next concept. There are concepts looking at folate conjugates. As many people know, ovarian cancer has a high level of folate receptor and is a very good differential target. And so there are upfront studies that are going to be looking at folate conjugates that will perhaps synergize with carboplatin and paclitaxel combinations. But I think those are the other targeted agents that are on the immediate horizon. I think that a little further back and not yet ready for phase 3 testing are the inhibitors within the PI3 kinase AKT mTOR pathway. And those agents are just finishing phase 1. They do seem to have some activity in selected patients with ovarian cancer. There are some interesting data which suggests that if one looks at the cancer genome atlas for ovary cancer, which is only serous cancer, and that's an important caveat, that ovarian cancer is not a disease of mutations as much as it is a disease of deletions, amplifications. And so while there are mutated PI3 kinase patients within that serous cancer population, it's much smaller than we might have expected. And instead, you're seeing amplifications of PI3 kinase, amplifications of the AKT family. And it's not so clear that amplification is going to be that useful as a marker. And that harkens back, of course, to the EGFR mutations in lung cancer, where overexpression of EGFR didn't actually turn out to predict erlotinib response. It was only the mutations of the EGFR that really gave a really strong signal. And so in ovarian cancer, I think we're trying to find our way forward, but I think the lack of a high frequency of gene mutation within typical targets, c-MET, EGFR, AKT, and so forth, have left us, I think, a little less sanguine about some of these very specific inhibitors.
And you mentioned PARP inhibitors. What about BRCA testing today? For example, did you do it in this 62-year-old woman? And do you think there's any practical reason in a woman without a family history or early age of diagnosis in considering testing?
Well, it probably depends some on where you are. Living in New York with a high number of Jewish women that come into our practice, we find that we're testing everybody, and even people without high numbers of relatives, we're finding mutations. And so we found it to be worthwhile. Now, the trick is that this concept of BRCA-ness is important, and that people have really focused on the idea that just because you've got a normal germline for BRCA1, which is what you test when you take the blood test, it doesn't mean that you don't have a somatic mutation of BRCA1 or BRCA2, which are common in the tumor themselves. And so a loss of BRCA1 or BRCA2 only in the tumor is seen in the TCGA data set. And then there are the patients who have normal genes, but have the genes silenced, either through methylation or other mechanisms. And those patients also act the same way. And so you can take that whole group to represent what they call BRCA-ness. And there are a number of groups who have suggested that you may be able to actually identify BRCA-ness from an immunohistochemistry approach. And I suspect, while that's not yet been validated with testing either in the germline or in somatic tumors, we're probably moving toward using immunohistochemistry as a strategy to at least identify patients who are at risk for carrying the mutation.
So did this woman get tested?
She did get tested. She was not a BRCA carrier.
You were talking about new agents and, you know, moving things up, et cetera, because you're talking about PARP inhibitors. And remember when I talked to you after the ASCO meeting last year and I said, you know, anything new that you're excited about, the first thing you brought up was AMG-386, an angiopoietin agent. And actually, Beth Carlin, who presented that, is on the same audio program that you're on. Where are we today with that?
Well, I think that there were very encouraging data presented on AM386. And I think that what we're learning that ovarian cancer is very much dependent on the angiogenesis pathway, perhaps more so than a variety of other tumors like colon cancer or breast cancer. And so I think ovarian cancer, as a consequence, has become a real arena for early development and approval of these other angiogenesis targeting strategies. Now, paradoxically, neither sunitinib nor sorafenib really had much activity. So the tyrosine kinase inhibitors have not been generally as good. The cedarinib is now in phase 3 testing, and that study will probably report out in time for next year's ASCO. And that may or may not turn out to be an important exception to the TKI statement that I just made. But I think that if one looks across the board at VEGF and similar angiogenesis targeting strategies using antibodies, there were a number of positive outcomes. And certainly the 386 was a very interesting study. The other study that was somewhat surprising was presented in poster form by Rob Coleman. And they looked at a combination of docetaxel and the so-called VEGF trap or aflibercept. And the thing that was interesting about that was that it was surprisingly effective because aflibercept had not done particularly well as single agent in ovarian cancer for reasons that nobody really understood. But the combination with docetaxel was absolutely stunning, and they had a response rate of over 60%. So I think that there may still be a way forward for aflibercept in development in ovary cancer, just as there, I think there's a way forward for the AM386.
So just picking up on a few of the things there. Now, aflibercept is a so-called VEGF trap. Would you care to comment on what that means and how that differs than, for example, bevacizumab?
Yeah, I think that the trap technology is an interesting strategy because what they've done is they've used DNA technology to clone out the sequence for the VEGF receptor, and then they fuse that sequence for the receptor to an antibody backbone. But rather than having the antibody actually raised against the target, they've used the receptor as the recognition sequence. And so that's really the difference. And the binding affinity can be higher than it is for most antibodies. So it was a little puzzling when the large phase 2 study that was done really didn't pan out to be nearly as promising as we had expected. And it was somewhat puzzling, and it probably had to do with patient selection because, of course, patient selection in phase 2 settings is always a pivotal issue. And unless you're doing a randomization with something that lets you know exactly what population you're treating, you can end up being deceived by the conscious and unconscious selection that goes into choosing patients for clinical trials.
Now, this paper by Rob Coleman that you were talking about with a 60% response rate, would you say everyone shares your enthusiasm or not? You know, because, of course, there wasn't a control arm.
There wasn't a control arm, and I gave Rob a little bit of a hard time about that in the discussion because that is an issue, and these kinds of trials can be deceptive. And so I think that the sponsors of aflibercept will have real hard decisions to make because it is on its face quite promising, but without a control arm, it's very hard to know exactly whether that was all, you know, the high performance status, excellent patients that make their way to MD Anderson.
You have a really great way of explaining pathways and novel agents. And I remember last year when you told me about AMG-386, you explained how it worked. Can you go through that again?
There are a variety of secondary targets that help blood vessels proliferate, and VEGF is one of them, but they can be substituted with angiopoietin and a variety of other secondary growth factors. The other important growth factor is probably the fibroblast growth factor.
Yeah, I just started hearing about that.
And, you know, patients who receive bevacizumab don't respond forever, and it's not as though the drug is disappearing from their bloodstream. What's really happening is alternative pathways are being used by the tumors, and whether it's angiopoietin or FGF or some other pathway, that a molecule that's not interacting with bevacizumab, which basically acts as a sink to prevent the VEGF from hitting its main target, but the FGF or the angiopoietin or others really are not then available. And so what happens is over time, George Sledge, in his presidential address, referred to smart tumors.
Right.
And the smart tumor concept is a useful one, which is that in the end, the tumors will figure out a way around any single blockade. And in the case of bevacizumab, those smart tumors are coming up with other proteins which can be secreted by the tumor and will allow those tumors to resume growth even in the absence of the VEGF that they would normally depend on for their blood vessels.
So you mentioned fibroblast growth factor. Do you know anything about the agent BIBF-1120? Because I've heard the actions of that TKI is to block the fibroblast growth factor.
That is exactly right. And that seems to have some promise. Now, if I owned one of those compounds, I would probably be looking at the bevacizumab failures as a rapid way forward because I think that you can go head-to-head with bevacizumab, but one of the other things we've learned about TKIs is TKIs are never quite as clean as you'd like them to be. They have classic side effects in terms of skin toxicity, palmar-plantar erythrodysesthesia. There are a variety of things that come out of those TKIs that make them a little less pleasant for the patients to take, and the fatigue is a common feature, for example. And so bevacizumab has good effectiveness, but it also has a very good toxicity profile. And so these TKIs, while I think they're promising and will probably come into second-line treatment, they do have more toxicity.
Any other comments about this agent BIBF-1120? What do we know about it in terms of efficacy and side effects?
I think efficacy, it has promising efficacy, and it was looked at in the platinum-resistant group, and it was certainly competitive, what you might expect from Doxil or one of the other agents. I think there's probably a way forward for this agent. Side effect-wise, it had TKI-like side effects, and so fatigue and some of the fluid retention, some of the other typical side effects associated with TKIs that are targeting the VEGF pathway were seen in that group as well.
So how about your 46-year-old lady?
Okay, so the 46-year-old lady was an interesting presentation because she really presented with pulmonary symptoms rather than the classic GI symptoms and was found at that point to have a large pleural effusion. And so I'm sure that when the docs began to work her up, they were thinking that she was going to turn out to have a lung cancer or mesothelioma. But when they actually did the VATS procedure, what she had was pleural studding and a serous cancer, which was WT1 positive, CA125 positive, and it became clear that this was somebody who was really having stage 4 ovary cancer. And then when they evaluated her pelvis, she indeed did have some slight increase in size of her ovaries, but she had really pulmonary dominant disease. So she underwent a full debulking surgery, and she indeed had a serous cancer in her ovaries, but really not much in her abdomen. Most of it was up in her pleura, and she was actually left below the diaphragm with no evidence of disease.
So she had a thoracotomy also to debulk?
She didn't have a thoracotomy. What she had was she had this VATS procedure, and she had small volume disease on her pleural surface.
So they just left it there?
They left it there. They can't really get rid of that.
And then they debulked her belly?
They did debulk her belly.
That seems a little strange.
Well, I was just going to make that point because it is intuitively strange because she is stage 4 from the time that they biopsy her pleura. But it turns out that if you reduce patients to optimal stage 4 disease, which is small volume disease in the abdomen as well, they do better than patients who are treated as suboptimal where you leave the disease behind. And so as a matter of routine at our place, we're more likely to offer these patients a surgical procedure if their abdominal CT suggests that we can get them down to very small volume disease. We don't offer those patients intraperitoneal treatment because historically we've been able to show that intraperitoneal treatment does not get high enough concentrations in the pleura to really treat stage 4 disease. So they all get IV treatment. But we do, as a matter of routine, offer debulking surgery to these patients.
So in this patient, you supported the debulking or you saw her afterwards?
I did support the debulking. I thought it was a reasonable thing to do.
Could you appreciate that somebody who's dealing with a lot of different diseases might look at this and go, geez, that's just kind of strange oncologic theory to do this?
Well, and certainly every time I do it, I sort of say, gee, does this make sense? Because it runs counter to all of the training that we all get as part of our fellowship. But this disease does have a difference in that, you know, our surgical principles have always been that if you can't get it all out, you shouldn't take any of it out. But for ovarian cancer, that's really not true. And if you can do a 90% debulking and remove most of it, that patient will do better. And so it's not exactly clear why ovarian cancer is different. There have been theories that maybe you're removing the poorly vascularized tissue that would otherwise not see high doses of the pharmacologic agents, that maybe that there's just you're reducing the total volume and so there are fewer mutations. I cannot explain it, but it is consistently shown to be true for ovary cancer, and it falls into the same category as I know some of my friends in some places and not all places will actually remove the renal primary from a patient with metastatic renal cancer. And again, you just feel like that's intuitively the wrong thing to do. But there are people who say that it actually prolongs survival and is advantageous. So I'm not advocating for renal cancer. I'm not a renal cancer expert, but I will say that there are diseases for which surgery for metastatic disease, where all the disease isn't really the target of surgery, does seem to have some proponents.
And that does bring back memories for me of many discussions about that, including with your colleague, Dr. Mosier. But there, a lot of times, I get the feeling they're kind of doing it palliative to prevent local problems. They think, right, you know, more likely they're going to have bleeding or pain or whatever. And whereas with ovary, it seems like more strategic systemically.
Right. I think that would be true, that we are really focused on the strategic benefit. And the other thing that has never been studied effectively in a randomized trial, but is very common in the ovarian cancer community, is resection of first recurrence. That if the first recurrence is in a confined area, that I think many gynecologic oncologists favor a surgical procedure to try to control that disease.
So what was the next step for this lady?
Well, because she had stage 4 disease and we weren't going to give her intraperitoneal treatment, she received carboplatin and paclitaxel. We have not yet adopted the Japanese weekly paclitaxel as a standard of care for these patients, although I think that there are those who would make that as an argument. And again, that was something from last year that I think we talked about, where the Japanese GOG suggested that 18 weeks of weekly paclitaxel plus carboplatin every 3 weeks had a better outcome than paclitaxel given on an every 3 week schedule with the carboplatin. But we don't routinely do that. That's still something that's under study in the States. But we did give her 6 cycles of carboplatin and paclitaxel.
And how did she tolerate it, and what was the next step?
Well, she tolerated it beautifully, and she really had no physical compromise at all. She had very little neuropathy. So she was someone that we thought was a candidate for some kind of a consolidation treatment. And the consolidation treatment has become sort of a thing in ovary cancer. So the consolidation strategies have included things like intraperitoneal treatment, Ovarex monoclonal antibody. She was offered and actually went on to a study receiving obagavimab, which is hard to say, but it was an anti-idiotypic vaccine where you basically are immunizing the patients with a CA125 mimic that raises an antibody to CA125. And this anti-idiotype strategy was used in a 800-patient study that was reported out by Jakob Pfisterer in the oral sessions of the GYN this time around. And unfortunately, that study turned out to be pretty definitively negative. There was really no advantage, no disadvantage, but no advantage to receiving that kind of consolidation therapy, that the patients had, at least in terms of relapse-free survival, no difference in outcome. And so that was obviously disappointing. There is a chance that the survival data will turn out to show an advantage, much like we saw with cipulucel-T in prostate cancer. And so I think we can't completely discard its utility, but I think it certainly is on supportive care pending the results of the survival data.
So what's this woman's current status?
She is, at this point, still disease-free, so she has not relapsed. And I guess that the other consolidation approach that I want to lift out in our discussion here is that this was a place where there was a very convincing study showing that the PARP inhibitors administered to patients who were in complete remission had a very prolonged time to relapse with a hazard ratio of 0.35, as I recall. It was absolutely stunning. This was for the olaparib, which was the first into clinic and probably still represents the lead compound. And it was very effective. And so I would say that the likelihood that this is going to turn out to be at least a protocol to look at consolidation therapy in a large group of patients is probably one of the next things that we're going to see.
If you could access it outside a protocol setting right now, would you use it? And if so, in what situation?
I think that there's very convincing data that for the BRCA-mutated patient, it is truly effective in anybody who retains platinum sensitivity. In the non-BRCA patient, it becomes much more of a crapshoot. I think that there are certainly many patients who do not have BRCA mutations who seem to respond to this agent. And one of the barriers to its development has been, do you choose to develop it only in the BRCA-mutated patient? Or do you go for the whole ball of wax and try to treat every ovarian cancer patient with this agent? But I think for a BRCA-mutated patient, some kind of a PARP inhibitor is a very logical intervention, and I would think that that would be a high priority.
I'm trying to remember, did they report BRCA data in that olaparib ASCO presentation?
Yes, and there were a lot of unknowns in that group. It was one of the reasons that it was criticized, is they didn't test everybody. they took the testing as it was known and reported that, but I think it was less than 40% were known to be BRCA carriers. So it was not perfectly done, but the data were quite compelling. And my guess is that by the time you throw in the somatic mutations of BRCA, the silencing of BRCA, and the patients who just have highly platinum-sensitive disease because they have somewhat diminished repair, you're seeing a large group of patients who are seeing some benefit from the PARP inhibitor.
So let's talk about your 75-year-old woman.
Okay. I picked this patient because this is somebody that I started on bevacizumab following ASCO about 4 years ago. And she had had multiple prior treatments. And frankly, I started her on bevacizumab mostly because I didn't have any other good ideas. And she was put on single-agent bevacizumab, and her CA-125, which was not a great marker for her, the highest that it ever was something over 300, fell dramatically and steadily over the course of the next several months to the point where she got down into the teens. And then I was sort of stuck. I didn't know what to do because logically, if you stop the drug, then you would expect that she might quickly relapse. And since at that time there was no good information on how long to give the bevacizumab, we just kept going. And she's tolerated it beautifully. She's gone back to running her own business. She's a caterer and finally, after 3 years on bevacizumab, finally sold her catering business because she was tired of the business, not because she was sick, and is now fully retired. But she's done extremely well and has really nothing in the way of side effects. After about 3 years, she developed pedal edema and turned out to have frank proteinuria over 4 grams. And that plus relatively low-grade hypertension, she was only on a single drug for her hypertension, we sent her to the renal folks and they said, you know, you really have to stop. So we did. And she did quite well for about 4 months. Her kidney function was gradually improved. She stopped spilling protein. Her edema went away, but her CA-125 began to rise. And so we eventually put her back on the bevacizumab at half dose in combination with weekly paclitaxel. And we've been able to treat her for more than a year now with half-dose bevacizumab, which she has tolerated again beautifully. She's had no recurrence of her proteinuria, although I suppose if I'm persistent enough, she will, and has continued to be very asymptomatic with a CA-125 below 30.
So it sure would be nice to pick people who are going to respond like this out in advance.
Wouldn't it?
any ideas, anything out there that looks promising to try to figure out who are people like this?
I think we're still completely in the dark on that. And it's, I think, one of the great needs in ovary cancer, at least, is to identify these people who are so incredibly dependent on the VEGF signal in order to maintain their tumors. And, you know, people have looked at a variety of markers. They've looked at nonspecific, just doing full genomic profiling using AFI chips and so forth. And nothing consistent has come out that really allows us to predict exactly who's going to benefit. And I think at this point, I still think that a trial of bevacizumab will help you figure this out pretty quickly, because the people who have the best responses are the ones that end up with very durable effects.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, and this 75-year-old woman, you mentioned that at the time you started the bevacizumab, she had an elevated CA-125 that fell. Where was her disease, and what was her symptomatology, and what happened on the Bev?
Well, she had ascites. Most of her disease was in the abdomen. Her oral intake was not great, and both of those things got better. She did not have pleural disease or really disease outside the abdominal cavity, but her fatigue was better. Her nutrition improved, and her ascites basically went away.
Do you think that people with advanced ovarian cancer who have ascites are more likely to be the ones who are going to benefit from Bev?
Well, I certainly think that the very advanced patient with refractory ascites is a good patient to treat with Bev, but the problem is that those are the patients with a lot of bowel wall involvement. And I think most of us would believe that the more advanced the patient and the more disease that the patient has at the time of beginning bevacizumab, the higher the risk is for perforation. And so I would say that on the one hand, patients with ascites are likely to benefit, and that has been discussed as a potential licensing strategy. But it's not so easy, and the risk of perforation has to be kept in mind if you're going to think about that.